Thanks very much for that introduction. I seem to come to Cork every 10 years or so. And Tom is always here. Very fond memories of coming to Cork in, I think it was 1981, 1982, and staying with Sean Dunn in his apartment, and waking up in this big white room that's completely empty. And you would never see anything like this in Dublin. I don't remember the exact address. It was a big house. You'd remember, Tom, where the room was.
Sydney Place.
Yeah, Sydney Place, yeah. And I always remember that. To me, it's kind of a place in my mind still. And I might read a poem about it later on. But I'll start off with the first poem in my new book. The reason is, when I was coming down to Cork today, I looked at the window and saw a basset hound. And you don't see basset hounds very often. And I love basset hounds. And the first poem in my new book is a poem about a basset hound that I was very attached to in Amsterdam. So it's called Elegy for a Basset Hound. Other dogs feared you, perhaps rightly. All that weight so close to the ground. The heft of those padded shoulders. The not-so-comical teeth concealed beneath your sad man jowls and pouches. English bred and born, according to the Basset experts. My neighbour plucked you off the autostrada near Lucca, where you were wandering confidently, like a 19th century English explorer, his mind gone in Antarctic snow. You settled into an Amsterdam bookshop, your basket firmly placed between the New York Review of Books and Literature in Translation, where you accepted the ministrations of single gentlemen, but fell in love with my wife and daughter, running away from home as often as you could, to climb like a legless man onto Judith's lap, where you slept for hours with one eye open. Untrainable, unbiddable, I could barely hold you back on the days I took you with me to collect Sarah from her school, and you made a beeline through the crush of mothers and bicycles to the class where the children fought to touch your mighty ears as you gambled ponderously on giant paws like an Ottoman pasha in his harem. And yet, I loved you for something else. How on a brown December night, when the light had soaked into the wet ground, I saw you through the dusk of Utrechtestraat, with trams and tea-time traffic crashing between us, out of earshot, almost out of sight. You turned on the crowded pavement, and like the old god of the Kabbalah, lost in the darkness and unknowing before creation, you raised your nose and sniffed the fouled air, and I knew that you had found me. Next poem is a very cheerful poem called Talith. And a Talith is what's usually known as a Jewish prayer shawl. And we have one at home, which we use. And it's quite an unusual thing to have, because a talith, for an Orthodox Jew, when you die, you're supposed to be buried in it. So an Orthodox Jew actually spends his whole life wearing his own shroud. But we have one, and the poem explains why we have one. It's called Talith. We sleep beneath your grandfather's talith. Fine lamb's wool striped black and white, a giant barcode to be scanned by God, the pelt of a fabulous beast. Little tent, portable temple. It survived Dutch looters and Dublin landlords to shelter in this Irish night, even me, uncircumcised and all too often unwashed. Your father pinned it to his study wall, a flag without a shield. eternity's quilt. Your grandfather didn't think he'd need it when he took the train in Amsterdam. And what, he mocked your father, are you going to murder us all? I'm going to read a poem, which is another poem on a Jewish theme. And I live in a part of Dublin called Portobello. It's a very interesting part of Dublin. It's really the old Jewish quarter of Dublin, Little Jerusalem, as it's called. And now it's mainly a Muslim area, which is an interesting pattern that repeats itself in Hamburg, Berlin, Amsterdam, Paris. As the Jews move out, Muslims move in. It's an interesting area for lots of other reasons, but it reminds me of Amsterdam. That's one of the reasons I lived there. So this poem is called The Cormorant, because in front of my window, I look down onto the canal and I see all these swans. And this cormorant appeared one day. And I knew I had to write about him. The cormorant. And it begins with a quotation from an 11th century Cordovan poet, Judah Halevi. My heart is in the east, but I am in the west. The cormorant. Hard to believe that these were once an emblem of the soul. These big creaking machines whose shit and drool fouls the towpath where I walk. Like a new tribe in from the Amazon jungle, they live on the city's margins, begging for stale bread. They have no fear, and without fear, there is no wonder. On weekends and holidays, the immigrants flock to feed them, taking photos of their children with the swans, to send back to Russia, to Lithuania, from where, 150 years ago, their neighbours flew out of a Chagall painting to end up here, in the red brick nests of Dublin's Little Jerusalem. Half a dozen streets, 11 synagogues, one for every village in their corner of that Slavic swamp where they had built a huge virtual landing pad on which the Messiah could land at any moment. Like Pope John Paul in the Phoenix Park, descending in his gleaming white chopper. I rise early on my birthday to watch the sun on the Wicklow Alps. From this glass room, like the bridge of a ship moored canal side. From the street, our friends look up to see us perform on the family stage. The swans are there below as usual, quietly beginning another day's work. When suddenly out of the east, like a wandering Jew, comes a cormorant, black as the flag which filled Paul Celan with such ecstasy, flying above the barricades in Paris 68. Dead centre, a yard above the water, he treads the canal through the city. The swans ignore him as he passes through and just above them, and, without an inch of deviation, flies right under the arch of Harold's Cross Bridge, dragging my heart with him. I have to immediately deconstruct that poem by saying that Michael Longley was in our house one night, and when we showed him the cormorant, he said, "Michael, that's not a cormorant, that's a shag." There you go. They look very similar. But I thought if the poem was called The Shag, it might have raised expectations that could not be met. About 7 years ago, I had an interesting experience. I was sent to a residency in Riga, in Latvia, for a couple of months. And Latvia was very interesting because I realised that nearly everybody in Latvia had a cousin in Ireland who was working here. Mainly in Cavan and Roscommon, places like that, picking mushrooms and things. So this was fascinating because Latvia, or Riga, was this beautiful 19th century city. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So I started to think a lot about Irish emigration and immigration. And I began to realize, you know, when the Irish emigrated, when we emigrated to America, you know, we had nothing, we were illiterate, and we were leaving holes in the bog and Dublin slums to go to New York. Whereas the people from Latvia were leaving this fantastic city built in the 19th century to come to Tala. So we were, they all had PhDs in linguistics, of course, as well. And so we were, to the Irish emigration was movement upwards, but to the Latvians, emigration was movement downwards. So I became very interested in it, and I decided to try and find out as much as I could about it. And somebody pointed out there was a Latvian poet who had lived in Ireland. He had come here as an immigrant, Mikaelis Norgulis. So I learned Latvian and translated some of his poetry. So I'll read a few of his poems. So this one's called, A Latvian Poet Writes an Ode to Capitalism. It was all very well for Pablo Neruda, Mayakovsky, and all those comrades to write their odes to labor. They had Stakhanovite steelworkers, drivers of red tractors breaking virgin soil. But what about me? How am I to praise the call center operative, the barista in the boutique hotel, the estate agent renting out boxes to Slovaks? I sit here 8 hours a day in my blue uniform at the cash register in Tesco's, trying to think of a name for what I actually do. My co-workers are called Mariska or Mohammed. I do not know where they live. I do not know what they eat. All I know is we are low caste priests in the greatest church that history has ever seen. The people come to the altar rail, we lay our hands on the fruits of the earth and give them back to the people who made them, blessed, sanctified, paid for. No, I don't feel up to writing an ode to people like myself. Anyway, there's a party in a flat in Baggett Street, and the guy from Brazil has some really good dope. So, Mikaelis Norgulis doesn't have such a good time working for Tesco's. So, he gets a job in a pub in Dublin called the Oliver St. John Gogarty, which some of you may know. No?
Yes.
Yep. Yes. It's a big tourist pub on the corner in Temple Bar. It's a pretty hideous place. But Mikaelis, like myself, Mikaelis has a lot of things in common with me. Like, he's obsessed with Yeats's vision, and he's obsessed with the Icelandic sagas. So, this is a poem he wrote about his time spent working as a kitchen porter in the Oliver St. John Gogarty. Ireland is such a wet country. Beer and vomit, semen and piss. In the downstairs toilet, an English woman is having sex with two Irish men. Up here in the kitchen, the Chinese giggle and the Polish porters glower. Me, I'm starting my coffee break, so I can return to Yeats's A Vision. I like to smoke and read a few lines and let his words roll round my head. Strange to think that all of us, the Poles, the Chinese, and me, once were children in shining white shirts with little red scarves around our necks, singing songs of hope and progress, not knowing we were the beast they feared so much over here that we almost blotted out the light. But the beast is dead, and we have come crawling like vermin out of its cold fur. Now my break is over, and it's back to work. I have to bring down some beer, huge barrels like steel pills, to be forced down the throat of the serpent which fills the streets of Temple Bar. There is no longer any darkness in the world. The light shines in every corner. I cannot sleep. I cannot dream. Like a medieval Latvian serf, I wait for something to wait for. So one day, Mikaelis Norgulis, our Latvian poet in Dublin, gets a day off work. So he decides to make a visit out to Killiney. Now, are you all familiar with Killiney, Killiney Hill in Dublin? No? Well, Killiney Hill is a very interesting place because it's the most expensive real estate in Ireland. And at the very top of Killiney Hill, or Queen Victoria's Hill, to give it its proper name, there's an obelisk which was built as a famine relief work in the early 19th century. But when you're on the top of the hill at the famine obelisk, you're looking down into the most expensive houses in Dublin. And the people down there are looking up at the obelisk, but it never puts them off the dinner. So Michaelis is trying to figure out why the Irish are so fucked up, basically. And every time he asks somebody, they all say, "Ah, sure, it's the famine." So that's why on the Sunday off, he decides to go out to Killiney to investigate the famine and figure it out. So this is called The Latvian Poet Climbs Killiney Hill. This city has dyed her hair blonde and had her breasts remodeled to look like the whore in the hotel foyer anywhere in the world. I want to know what she looked like before, so I climb Queen Victoria's Hill to look at the famine obelisk, because I know that hunger is the true god of the Irish. It came down from the mountain and gave them two commandments: thou shalt devour and thou shalt hate, and laugh and dance and sing to fool the angel of death into thinking you're alive. Looking down the hill at the muddy path, I think I see her looking up, half crawling. Yellow maize porridge cakes her lips. Her breasts hang slack and luscious as dying fruit in her ribcage, which trembles like a songbird's throat. Her skin is white as the mushrooms in the cold ground of the Latvian forest, but her eyes and hair are black. Black as the wind in the thorn bush. Black as potatoes rotting forever deep in the black earth. I noticed that next week there's a Michael Hartnett evening, so I'm going to read a Michael Hartnett poem. Years ago, I think in the mid-1980s, I did a tour with Michael Hartnett around various places in Ireland. And I didn't speak any Irish, and I was quite hostile towards the Irish language. And Michael was reading stuff in Irish, and I was reading stuff in English. And I didn't really know what he was reading. But I've since changed my mind about the Irish language, and be happy to hear. So I wrote this poem about that experience. It's called On Hearing Michael Hartnett read his poetry in Irish. And at the time, he had just given up English. And there's a very good recording. Somebody sent me a tape a while ago they'd found in the RTE archive. There's a very good recording made in the poetry program in the 80s. I think it might be on a podcast now, where I'm reading this poem and he's actually reading an Irish poem simultaneously. It's all very avant-garde. I'm hearing Michael Hartnett read his poetry in Irish. First, the irretrievable arrow of the military road, drawing a line across all that has gone before. its language a handful of brutal monosyllables. By the side of the road, the buildings eased up. The sturdy syntax of castle and barracks, the rococo flourish of a stately home, the formal perfection and grace of the temples of neoclassical government, the avenues describing an elegant period. Then, the red brick constructions of a common coin to be minted in local stone, and beyond them, the fluent sprawl of the Muttock suburbs, tanged with the ice of its bitter nights, where I dreamt in the shambles of imperial ions, like rows of shattered Georgian houses. I hear our history on my tongue, the music of what has happened, the shanties that huddled around the manor, the kips that cursed under Christchurch Cathedral, rising like a madrigal into the Dublin sky. But tonight, for the first time, I heard the sound of the snow falling through moonlight onto the empty fields. Next poem is a longish kind of a poem. I wasn't going to read it, but I was talking to Tom and I suddenly thought I'd read it because it has its origins in Cork in a strange way. A few years ago, I was at a lecture by Elaine Aquilinon, who's from Cork, and she was talking about her family and how when she was a child, all her aunts were nuns and they'd only see each other once a year, and they'd be having Christmas dinner at the table. There'd be her, her father, her mother, and her seven aunts. And she said that she suddenly woke up when she was about 60 years old. One night, she woke up in the middle of the night and said, "What the fuck was wrong with that family?" And it had never occurred to her in all the years that she'd been writing poetry and so forth. It had never occurred to her to ask her father or her aunts, "Why did you all become nuns? You know, was there sexual abuse? What was happening? You know, why did nobody want to reproduce?" And it made me think about my own family, because the things that are staring you in the face are usually the things that you can't see in your own family. And I grew up in a family where it was dominated by two grandmothers. And one grandmother in particular, my Dublin grandmother, I wrote a few poems about her in earlier books, and she was a very colourful character, a real Dublin woman. And it's only in recent years, when my father died, I began to realise that she was actually an evil, controlling old bitch. And there's this cult in Ireland of, you know, never speak ill of the dead and never speak ill of your mother. But, you know, Irish mothers can be evil. Sorry if there's any here. The more I started thinking about her and my uncles and my aunts, I began to realise how she had destroyed everybody's life and poisoned it at the root.
She made you manual.
But this is it, you see. I mean, maybe I'm the same. But it's very difficult to look objectively at these things. And this is what I was trying to do in this poem. And the poem actually starts off that way, as an attempt to deconstruct the Irish mammy. But it ends up becoming something completely different, luckily enough. So, no offence to Irish grannies. It's called The Widow's Prayers, with the apostrophe after the S. The only thing I need to say about the poem is that the two wars which are referred to in the poem are the First World War, or the Great War, and the Irish Civil War. And my grandfather fought in both of them. He actually came to Cork with the Dublin guards and landed in a ship in Cork Harbour. And I always remember him telling me that he got off the ship and people started shooting at him. And that was his main memory of Cork.
We hope you don't end up the same.
Well, no. I was wondering if I should actually tell you that, but those days are gone. It's all over now. Anyway. He survived, that's the main thing. Okay, The Widow's Prayer. You were born to be a widow. Not that you didn't love Michael O'Loughlin, my father's poor father, But you broke them anyway, the way you broke your five strong sons. I've read Freud, I've read Jung, but there's nothing here to analyze. Their theories break on your brute existence like snow on a bonfire, leaving you intact. Proletarian bitch goddess, virgin queen patrolling your realm for 30 years, obscenely alive, moving amoeba-like through these ancient streets, a monument to mere survival, life at its most stripped down. Your widowhood was electric. I remember my uncle's giants kneeling at your feet in the tiny kitchen of the house Big Jim Larkin gave you, smaller than the cars they had parked outside. But you shrank them like some sci-fi machine. Even now, the perspective dizzies me. The only thing that was constant was the framed photo of Michael Collins. All your life you played in the giant Las Vegas of the Catholic Church, with its casinos of sorrowful murmurs, the one-armed bandits of the soul, the flashing lights, the bells, the jackpots of Lourdes and Fatima. I'd love to know what deal you struck, the thing you claimed created you. In my Vanda Yara, I wrote to no one, friends or family, trying to pare myself down to essence. But in every town I came to, I hunted out the local virgin, always surprised to find there was one, and sent you postcards of her different faces. We never talked about it, but you placed them in line, stuck in the frame of a picture of the Sacred Heart beside the Child of Prague in your front bedroom. Why were you the way you were? Original Sin or Oliver Cromwell? The Act of Union 1801? 12 to a room in the Georgian tenements? The impacted pain? The squalor of drunken soldiers rollicking in the biggest brothel in Europe? The strikes, the lockout, the Somme, the black and tan shot dead in the local fish and chip shop, the Free State Army who shelled your house with borrowed British armoury. In that holiday snap from the 20s, my blonde, blue-eyed grandfather, home from the war in Kerry, shirt-sleeved and smiling, lies relaxed on the Free State beach, having survived a second time. But you are sitting upright beside him, dressed in your Sunday best, bristling with black energy, a backstreet sphinx on the sands, your face insolent, ignorant, unreconciled. You loved me more than you did the others. Maybe you saw something of yourself in me. Maybe you put something of yourself in me. What was looking out at me through your transparent eyes but the species, nature, mutation, chance and necessity? The O'Loughlins are a family of gamblers, but I never did. Maybe I myself am the gamble, rocketing round the map like a roulette ball, unable to choose between red and black, aware that the house always wins. Now I take the new electric tram through your native realm, and I pass through those old places. The church where you had me initiated into the rites of your tribe. My first school, the distillery where you took me one day to meet my father, emerging from this brick and copper cathedral of noise and sweet smells, wearing blue overalls and a mask like a figure in a socialist realist painting. And as I look out, I always think of Polanski's film, The Pianist, where the tram bisects the Warsaw ghetto, the passengers not staring at a zoo whose business was survival, and now, like this one, has disappeared beneath designer restaurants, shining apartment blocks. I'm beginning to understand why I keep sniffing around ghettos in Amsterdam, Riga, and Vilna, looking for my childhood streets, now gone like Ruthenia, a country which only lasted for 3 days. 3 days or 1,000 years. What does it matter to Benjamin's angel of history his wings propelling him to paradise, gazing backward at the growing pile of debris. His focus tilts the planet and time like a child's kaleidoscope. Decades and distances blur from Volgograd to Dusseldorf, from Dublin to Barcelona. He sees tens of millions of old women walking painfully to market, with string bags and coloured headscarves, struggling against the wind. The wind that is blowing him to paradise. And looking back, he sees the air singing with the dead, and how the widow's prayers come together, a cloud of grey radioactive dust to enshroud the fading planet. Well, actually, she wasn't that bad at all. That's just one side of the story. I think I'll finish up. I'm going to do something I've never done before, which is read a new poem. I was very impressed earlier on. I find it very difficult to finish poems. I spend years on a poem. I'm very impressed when people can write something in 5 minutes. I can't. I can write 2 words a month, usually. And I tend to, when I write a poem, I tend to start it off and spend years on it. And I suppose what I'm trying to do is to make it look as if I've just thought of it that moment. And, you know, some people say I do that all too successfully. But for a couple of years, I was working on a poem called The Trick of the Light. And it's gone through lots of different versions. And I think at the moment, everybody here and everybody in this room is thinking in a way of Seamus Heaney and what it means for Irish poetry, what it means for us personally, because it's a big change, and it's like a huge tree has crashed in the forest. It's the reverberations are still there. And I don't know if you heard, but near where I live, there's a restaurant called the Canal Bank Cafe on Leeson Street. The Anal Bank Cafe, we call it, because people keep removing the C to keep stealing the letter. But it was Seamus Heaney's favourite restaurant, and we often used to see him there. And he 2 weeks ago, he was coming out of the restaurant and he stumbled and he fell and needed a small operation, which led to his death. And the strange thing was, for about 2 years, I've been trying to write a poem called The Trick of the Light, which is about people falling. And I couldn't finish it. And the last verse in it was about Robert Lowell. And I'd interviewed Seamus Heaney a couple of years ago for a thing about Robert Lowell. And for some reason, it didn't fit in. And when I heard he had died in this way, it was I got kind of an eerie feeling, because I knew I had the last verse of the poem, which I wrote last week. And I very rarely do this. I tend to sit on a poem for a year or two. But I'll just read it anyway. I'll probably burn it afterwards. It's called A Trick of the Light. And it refers to two people, apart from James Heaney, Gaudí, the architect in Barcelona, where I lived for a few years, of the cathedral there. And a visionary architect called Louis Kahn, who's kind of one of my big heroes. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He built a number of buildings in the 50s and 60s, 70s in America, and he built the Parliament buildings in Lahore in Bangladesh, which he designed to be bombed. He said, I want to build buildings that look better after they've been bombed. So I hope you don't love the guy. A trick of the light. Oh, sorry, when he died, they found that he had all kind of weird identification on him. It turned out like many people, he had two completely different lives. He had wife and children in New York and a wife and children in Baltimore for 30 years, and his two families never knew about each other. I don't know how people get the energy. So I'll finish with this poem, A Trick of the Light. I thought the dark would just keep growing till I was blotted out. I hadn't expected this. The way is more like being surrounded by walls from which each day a brick is removed, so the light floods in to dazzle you till you fall. Like Gaudí, the cathedral unfinished, struck by a tram and left to die, mistaken for a tramp maybe recognized as such. Or like Louis Kahn, stricken while shuttling between lives on the yellow-stained floor of a restroom in Pennsylvania Station. Or Seamus Heaney, stumbling on Leeson Street, shucking off the dream of clay, falling into the light.